Go.
Hi, and welcome to the Bad Idea Podcast. I don't even remember what number we're on anymore, so I'm not going to fake
eight.
It.
Is it eight? Eight?
Okay. But yeah, for the month of October, we wanted to pick a theme that was...
Introduce us!
They know who we are!
They don't know who we are!
Fine, I'm Steve Carlson.
And I'm Simon Abrams.
Yeah. Anyway.
We've been drinking.
Yes, we have been drinking a little bit.
Just one beer.
Just one beer.
It was 11% alcohol, though.
It was a pretty strong beer.
It was a good beer.
It was a damn good beer.
Anyway, go ahead.
What, can't we just podcast about the beer?
Anyway. this is not Halloween appropriate, Steve Carlson.
You're right.
Although that would be a bad idea, fitting in with the theme of this podcast, in case you're joining us for the first time.
Which you're not. But we love you anyway.
Some.
All of you. What can I say? I have a big heart.
He's lying.
I am.
He's lying!
I am. Anyway, we wanted to pick a theme that would be Halloween appropriate, i.e., you know, all horror movies.
Woo!
And Simon had mentioned that he was doing a 31 Days of Horror thing, an outlet he writes for, and mentioned that he had both Grizzly and Three on a Meat Hook in his queue.
Yeah. No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
I didn't have Three on a Meat Hook.
Maybe it was the Manitou then, but it was...
I didn't have the Manitou in my queue.
Day of the Animals, maybe it was.
I didn't have Day of the Manitou.
You did.
No.
Well, anyway, you had Grizzly in your queue, and you had...
No, I didn't.
You did.
You mentioned the idea of doing... Okay, folks.
Anyway.
We're having technical difficulties here. Steve doesn't seem to remember the fact that we were both curious about seeing Grizzly, because it came at one point while we were both drunk, and we were like, Grizzly. And then we were both like, what should we do? And it's like, for our next Halloween-themed podcast, we're like, maybe we should do the films of the director of Pieces. It's like, oh, how about maybe the films of the director of Grizzly? And I was like, what else did he do? And we mentioned the idea that this is the guy that's also responsible for The Manitou, which I know the AV Club Zach Hamlin, hi Zach, is very fond of. And it sounded kind of awesome based on his description of it. And I was, you know...
Neck fetus,
yeah. Tony Curtis fighting a neck fetus.
Damn right.
So I was like, we gotta give that a shot.
Yeah.
And honestly, apart from the abuse of praise that Hanlon gave it, I didn't know anything about it.
Incidentally, you should probably mention the name of this director who we were talking about in generalities. It's a fellow named William Girdler.
Girdler.
Yes. A Kentucky-born auteur du cinéma who made nine low-budget films in the 70s and then died in a plane crash while researching his eighth film. Tenth film, actually. He made nine
films.
Yes.
Tell him about that tenth film, by the way.
The tenth film, according to the liner notes for the first film we're going to talk about, was intended to be a film about drug smuggling entitled Opium, starring Marlon Brando.
Smuggles drugs.
A movie starring late 70s Marlon Brando from the director of The Manitou.
Last thing I put on this drugs.
We're talking a lost masterpiece here, people.
This is secret business.
This would have been the most incredible movie ever made.
For your eyes on.
But... Anyway, so yeah, William Girdler is the theme of this month's podcast.
Definitely.
And we should probably...
do the podcast in that voice, by the way.
In the Brando late 70s voice?
Yeah, exactly. Continue as you were.
So we decided we'd pick out his four genre entries.
Four.
He actually made five, but we're not going to cover Day of the Animals. We might save that for a later podcast.
I'll save that later.
Yes. You gotta stop that, man. I'm not gonna be able to keep a straight face.
As if they... This is a podcast! Anyway, yeah.
It's just gonna be, you know, an hour of you using that voice and me just giggling.
Me!
And, you know, I understand that we're pretty loose here, but that may be a bit looser than our six listeners are used to.
Hi, guys!
If you send us all your names, we'll thank you individually.
Yes, in the next podcast. Wouldn't it be exciting?
Yeah.
Our badgering you into listening to a podcast that you probably won't listen to in the first place if you weren't already friends with us.
Well, that's why we have friends. So people can listen to
friends.
Us rant.
Friends.
Ouch.
How soon? Anyway.
Nuking!
So,
anyway, yes, let's
William Girdler, the first film we're talking about is Asylum of Satan. And
his debut film, released in 1972.
When was it produced?
I believe it was filmed in 1971. With mostly locally sourced talent from in and around Louisville, Kentucky.
It certainly
looks like it.
See, here's the main difference of opinion here. Steve seems to think that, let me lay out my
yeah, let's start with Asylum and go from there.
Asylum of Satan is basically a movie that has a very, very basic premise. Woman is going crazy in an asylum that may or may not have been shut down years ago. Her fellow inmates are a blind woman, a woman that is crippled and has no legs, and a mute man. And she is constantly protesting to the doctor, Dr. Spector, who is not related to Phil, by the way,
or Arlen.
Oh, not related to Arlen either. She's perfectly sane, she doesn't know what she's doing in the asylum. You know, the basic setup. And, you know, she's waiting for someone to come in and rescue her, but unfortunately the local sheriff doesn't seem to be able to get anyone that seems to know what's going on. Everyone says, or the groundskeeper says, well, this asylum's been shut down for years, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Now, this is such a, you know,
It's a very, very hackneyed premise.
Not hackneyed, but very generic.
It's
a very generic premise because
okay, I will settle on well worn.
Okay, and the point is, I think Girdler does a pretty interesting, or he does a fitfully interesting job because there are parts where he clearly shows that he doesn't have a fucking clue as to how to do it. He's kind of like an Ed Wood filmmaker in certain ways because these films that we're talking about are all very personal, but at the same time, he just doesn't have the means to do anything with them. And B, sometimes the imagination to do anything. I think in certain scenes he shows that he has an eye for, if not composition, he has an intuitive understanding of how to make a scene scary. Like, there's one scene where the inmate, the female protagonist, is running through the asylum, and she's being chased by this deformed monster, and the camera...
There's a giant boil or something over his eye. It's a very bizarre makeup job.
It's a bizarre makeup job, but it's an evocative, I think, lighting effect that shows you this person coming out of the dark and our protagonist running away from them, and combined with like the kind of creepy, I think, soundtrack during that moment, it worked for me. I think honestly, this is my premise for the first two films we're going to talk about, Asylum of Satan and Brianna Meat Hook. I think that both of these films could really be terrific if they were remade with a bigger budget. I think if Girdler had survived and done these again, I think you could have had like a real something that's more than just a diamond in the rough. Really, really rough though. There are scenes like there's a scene where the blind inmate gets attacked by a rubber snake in the pool. I cannot defend for the life of me that scene because it's god awful.
It's pretty indefensible, and I kind of think the majority of the movie is indefensible. I'm inclined to agree with you on the potential embedded in Three and a Meat Hook, and we'll get to that, mainly because a lot of the potential is kind of embedded in the structure, which Girdler is ripping off from another source.
Yes.
But Asylum of Satan, I don't see a lot there. I mean, what you see as evocative, I see as simply underlit.
No, that's the thing. I'm not saying that it's evocative because it's dark.
No, I understand what you're saying. I don't think he builds any atmosphere. I just think it's a lot of people wandering around in hallways with no light bulbs.
Well, that's the thing. Your use of the verb "builds" implies that, like, this is, again, I think Girdler is a very intuitive filmmaker. He doesn't do anything with a plan in mind. And I think that's why his films are so frustrating, because when he actually finds something that he actually finds convincingly scary, it's not necessarily by design. It's not something that he will develop in later scenes as consistently as we'd like him to. Like that scene I mentioned where...
With the main character running down the hall, yes.
Yeah, that scene and certain others, like one where she's trying to signal someone outside of the asylum to look at her, and she's in this big window, and she's just banging on the window. That's a beautiful scene, and I think part of it is location. I think it's just partly just the location and the luck that he had in getting that good angle of the shot. But part of me just thinks that, you know, that's part of movie making, you know, being able to run with the tools that you have on hand. And I think Girdler does a good job.
That's a fair assessment. And I will say that I've actually seen Asylum of Satan before. And while still thinking it a very poor piece of cinema, I did enjoy it more this time than I did the first time I saw it. If only because, as I discussed, I kind of realized that Girdler, who is, from the little I've read on him, quite a film fan, is taking it upon himself to kind of make this satanic little ditty a quasi-remake of Wizard of Oz.
Well, it's certainly a pastiche of elements from Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
I think tell them what you mean. This is interesting.
There's a scene in it. It first kind of started tickling at the back of my head when there's a scene where the boyfriend of the main female, the woman who is in this asylum against her will and cannot leave because Dr. Spectre, with his amazing beard mustache combo.
Oh my God! It's pasted on with like. Oh my God!
It's
rubber cement.
It's
amazing.
It's the mustache is pretty cool, but yeah, the beard has like three or four prongs on it, and it's all spiky and jagged.
And then there's several inches to it. It just like sticks out in either direction, and it's like a small pencil eraser. It's kind of incredible.
It looks like he's wearing an upside down EKG on his face, and it's kind of like if Anton LaVey really let himself go. It's pretty amazing, but so her fiance is there trying to get the most assholish cop in the world to believe his story about her possibly being kidnapped and held in this asylum, which as they walk up to it, they realize, wait, this thing's been closed for 20 years.
Bum bum bum
bum bum bum, and the cop says something along the lines of, "So this is Oz, and you're the wizard," which is a cute little line of dialogue, but not. 5 minutes later, there's a scene where the woman is in the asylum. She's being held there by the main nurse, who incidentally is played by Dr. Spectre in drag, in an inexplicable touch that no one ever bothers to actually clarify. It's just a bit of random weirdness. And she's, you know, the doctor's explaining that, no, you didn't actually get chased down a hallway by a deformed guy last night. You were just having a dream. It's really just a dream. And the woman's going, but no, but Dr. Spectre was there, and you were there. And it's, suddenly it's this clear, like, and you were there, and you were there, and Toto was there kind of moment. And it's like, wow. And then my mind started reeling on it further, and I realized she has three companions. The blind girl, the woman in the wheelchair, and the mute man. All of whom are missing crucial parts of their bodies.
Like the scarecrow that's in the Towers of Light.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of inspired when you think about it.
And it kind of started hitting me that, you know, even with this you know, clearly learning on the job, this technique that strikes me mostly as incompetent, there's still something going on intellectually there.
Yep.
That, you know, that Girdler, there was promise there that I wasn't seeing before.
On the other hand, one could, I wouldn't make this argument, but I think one could cynically dismiss that as, like, you know, he's grasping for a theme and a significance that he doesn't follow through on. But again, I don't think that Girdler is the kind of filmmaker that sees something and tries to do more than just, play around with ideas and themes. Like, to call him out, as someone that's, like, trying to elevate schlocky material that is, you know, thrice done over, is to ignore something that's basic to all the films we're going to talk about.
His films seem to work less as constructed narratives and more as series of moments that lurch from place to place.
But not just that. I mean, in the film that we're going to talk about, and I think this is a good transition, in Three on a Meat Hook, the next film he did he produce that the same year? Or was that 72?
Three on a Meat Hook was the next year.
72.
Three on a Meat Hook was, I believe, filmed in... I believe it was filmed in early 73.
Okay.
Released late 73, which gives it the unintended advantage of actually getting an ace on both Deranged, the Bob Clark, Alan Ormsby film, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, both of which are... much better known iterations on the Ed Gein tale that Girdler's playing with there.
Like now
Girdler's kind of doing it secondhand because, as we'll get into, again, he has a very, very famous influence here that he's working with.
Yes, Three on a Meat Hook is very much Girdler's attempt at doing a riff on Psycho.
And this is clearly a film that influenced him as a young cinema goer because he includes a Psycho homage in the middle of Silence of Satan as well.
One of the characters is dressed in drag. One of the things that just seems very inexplicable and one of the things that just makes it seem like an Ed Wood quality film is that Dr. Spector is clearly she's supposed to be a woman, but at the same time she has a man's body and very hairy
arms. That's not actually what I was intending.
But no, I know. But yeah. But furthermore, I mean, the idea that you have this character that's like dressed up like that, and we know is in drag, and
yeah.
that's part of it. But the other part is
it's the bit where the lead female is stripping down for a bath.
Yes, and there's a peephole in the medicine cabinet where Dr. Spector is observing her. And that is clearly an homage to Psycho.
Absolutely.
And Three on a Meat Hook, you even have more so in terms of plot in several scenes that are direct homages.
Three on a Meat Hook, in a lot of ways, is a direct remake.
No, I disagree.
In terms of its beats, I mean, and thematically, in a way, I think it does kind of diverge at the end, obviously.
Well,
it even ends with the psychiatrist monologue, and then then it cuts to a shot of its prime villain in voiceover narration talking to himself.
So, Three on a Meat Hook follows this character that has been led to believe by his father that he's responsible for murdering his mother.
Billy.
Billy's the main character. Yeah. And Billy has been warned by his father that he needs to stay away from women from that point on, and that he needs to stay with his father.
You know how you get around them.
Yeah, exactly. That was a good thing.
You're welcome.
And the father is a total drunk. They live on a farm. And this will change naturally, or the boy's, Billy's impulse to stay away from women naturally changes when he meets a girl, he falls in love, yada, yada, yada.
Who, incidentally, is played by the blind girl from Asylum of Satan.
Yes. Girdler is not unlike Tim Burton.
Reusing a lot of personnel action. from Asylum of Satan, I guess. Probably because he knew these people, and judging from the liner notes that I have for Asylum of Satan, it was kind of a big flop. So, Three on a Meat Hook, he got like half the financing that he did for Asylum of Satan, which is kind of amazing considering how cheap Asylum of Satan looks.
It looked like it was made on like a budget of like $1.75.
Yeah, and Three on a Meat Hook was made for less than that, but I think it's a more professional looking film.
Three on a
even
Meat Hook,
even
yeah.
through the shitty DVD we were watching.
The problem with Three on a Meat Hook is that it's even more boring to look at than Asylum of Satan, I would argue. Girdler doesn't have an idea of where to put his camera, because again, he's very... He responds to his instincts, I think, a lot of time as a director. And unfortunately, that means that he doesn't know when to cut elements of his story to suit a better rhythm for his film and a better character arc for his characters. So the main thing that makes Three on a Meat Hook interesting is the fact that you have this character that has a very interesting and believable psychosis. You know, he's intrinsically trusting of his father, despite the fact that his father's deeply untrustworthy. He's a drunk, he's an unreliable narrator, or unreliable protagonist. But the fact is, the one reason why we have to believe Billy and his fear of being a killer is early on in the film, in one of the most ridiculous parts of the film, but the only parts that brand it as a real horror film, rather than just like a psychological thriller, are the scene where like a couple of girls stay over at the house and they all die gruesome deaths.
Yes.
Including one really memorable beheading, which is...
Yeah.
That is a
well,
really...
Well, the beheading is a really killer effect, and I'm curious how Girdler achieved it. But at the same time, I think that entire sequence is pretty fairly well edited and directed, just in terms of cutting around the unseen protagonist holding the gun, holding the shotgun, and cutting to the girls running, and then smash cut, fire gun, girl fall down with squib, and it was probably more difficult to construct that sequence the way it's presented than it looks.
I agree, and I think part of that is the power of montage, and honestly, I think that it's it's edited impeccably. I can't say enough about how effective just seeing that like quick cut away from that woman's head being like lopped off by an axe,
and then the body
held up by that axe, and then quick cut, and you're just like the after effect of that image, or the after image is burned into your memory. You're like, whoa, did I just see what I think I did?
And but, you know, let's be honest, the effect itself is probably pretty simple. It probably just involved the actress sticking her head through a hole in a wall.
Sure.
But the way it's edited is just so quick that you don't really have time to think about that until afterwards. Just like, oh my god! You know? So I do think that this is kind of a film where Girdler starts to get his feet under him in terms of technique.
Our friend, by the way, Henry Asman, was the film editor for the film. So
it's Bud Asman, who's our
friend. Multiple Asman.
There are a number of people with the last name of Asman. Asman.
There's lots of Assman on this.
Yes.
Lots of.
Apparently, Girdler was friendly with a clan of Assmen.
Lots of keep firing Assmen. Yes.
I'm the Assman.
Anyway, so. Plus, honestly, I think that the makeup effect for that scene is pretty cool. Yeah. J.G. Patterson Jr. did some makeup effects.
J.G. Patterson Jr. was, if you don't know his name, incidentally, J.G. Patterson Jr. was a fairly instrumental figure in a lot of 70s exploitation. Solid makeup artist, former magician, turned makeup artist, compatriot of Herschel Gordon Lewis, and possibly the worst director to work in the 70s.
What did he do, Joseph Frank?
He did a film called Dr. Gore, a.k.a. The Body Shop, which is terrible, terrible movie. And a weird sort of Southern Fried morality play called The Electric Chair, which is available as the co-feature on Something Weird's now-out-of-print Axe DVD.
But yeah, back to 3 on a Meat Hook, I find it really compelling because... Yeah. If there weren't such a major lull in the story when you're establishing the happy brief period that Billy has with this girl that he's seeing before he has to go back to the idea that, oh no, I'm actually a killer, which is, it's filmed in totally prosaic and cliche images of like frolicking through fields and
it's very basic and that's kind of my main. Even though I think it's an advance over Asylum of Satan, I'm still kind of on it. I think overall it's not a terribly good film, precisely because it's a film that has essentially one very thin conceit, and it's desperately trying everything it can do to direct your attention away from the very obvious secret at the heart of the film. Secret, incidentally, that the title itself gives away.
Here's the thing. You say it's obvious. I didn't find it obvious at all.
I caught it the minute Billy said, 10 minutes into the film, when Billy is talking to the four girls who are in his house, and he says, "Nobody smokes meat like my pa." I knew exactly where it was going after that.
I totally didn't put that much importance into it because the thing is,
it's maybe I just watched too many horror films. But
well, it's not just that. I just think that honestly, like. The way that this film is shot in such a way that, like, I don't think that you can... I mean, maybe I really just was susceptible to the film's charms, but I felt that it didn't feel like a telling sign any more than, you know, the idea that, like, well, it's just his awkward way of developing, like, well, I don't know what else to say to these girls. All I know about this farm is, you know, what me and my dad do, but... Yeah. Again, this is probably just rationalization, honestly. I just didn't pick up on it.
It's just because, you know, because I watch a lot of genre films, when I hear about people smoking meat, my mind reels over to Texas Chainsaw, reels over to Deranged, you know, the other films made in the vein of this movie, honestly, without even being able to control them, automatically thinking cannibalism. I will admit, I didn't see the ultimate twist coming. The ultimate twist of the identity of the familial cannibal, as it were. I think that's something that the film has going for it in terms of where it's coming from in that regard, in how it's in the thematic issue it's trying to present there. And again, I don't think Girdler I don't know if it's necessarily that he didn't quite have a handle on the material and wasn't able to develop it, or if he just wasn't terribly interested in it. Because, like you say, he does seem to kind of be working moment to moment on a lot of these films. But, you know, I do think the film eventually ends up somewhere fairly interesting in that last in the last psychiatrist monologue, which again, you know, clearly ripped from Psycho, but Girdler's pushing it in a different direction. In that, where he's the motivations he's explaining for the killer have more to do with overprotective familial love and less psychosis, mm. where the psychosis seems to have come afterward,
yeah.
Like something developed out of the impossible situation in which the killer finds himself in, mm. and it's crude, but I think there's something very effective there.
Yes, it's one of the reasons why I think both this and Asylum of the Saint would benefit greatly from a remake, whether it could have been, as long as we're in the realm of, well, what if Girdler could have done it himself?
Mm.
Because his later films do clearly have a budget.
There's definitely more polish there.
And there's not only a greater budget, as you say, there's greater understanding of how to make films. There's a greater technical accomplishment to the way that he does scare scenes, and I think he just knows where to put a camera more. On, like, in a movie like Three on a Meat Hook, it bothered me more there, especially during, like, the scenes where Billy and his girl are like, oh, we're happy together, yeah. We're frolicking.
It's a film that has only 78 minutes to kill, but there's a lot of dead air in there.
Yeah.
Because, I just don't think that once Girdler set up the main conflict, I don't think he quite knew what to do with it.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, let's be honest, I mean, Psycho is, in that regard, you know, it's kind of a one-idea film, too, but A, Hitchcock was making it, and Hitchcock is an infinitely smarter and better filmmaker, and B, it also saves its big, you know, oh, these girls are our protagonists. Oh, nope, not anymore, they're not.
Not anymore, you're not.
You know, Psycho saves that for halfway through the film. Three on a Meat Hook gets rid of its four, you know, potential protagonists 15 minutes into the movie.
Right. Yeah, and exactly, the thing is, like, I think with a filmmaker like that, again, it speaks to the fact that he wants to set things up very quickly. He wants you to know what's at stake, but at the same time, barring, you know, the girl that Billy's in love with, there isn't anyone that's really being threatened by the insanity in Billy's life.
For better or worse, because of the setup between, you know, where Pa is trying to protect, quote unquote, Billy from Billy's own insanity, it becomes a very insular world that these two have constructed, and as such, it's very difficult to bring in, you know, new people to be threatened by it.
I mean, realistically, you shouldn't need more than one character, even including Billy. Like, just the fact that you have Billy, the girl, and the father, that should be enough.
Well, yes, if you're making a psychological thriller, yes, but
Girdler doesn't go into that, yeah. Even. He doesn't show you the panic and the depths of this guy's fear of doing something to this girl that he cares so much about, and he doesn't really show you the depths of his, how much he cares about this girl beyond, yeah. Like, as we keep, like, as I keep mentioning,
hey, it's my first experience with a girl out by myself. She's nice, I like her. Oh, suddenly we're in love!
Yeah.
A week later.
Yeah, it's very much like the filmmaker has Asperger's. Like, it's very, you know, emotionally stunted, doesn't have a conscious idea of how to express the depth of its feelings.
Yeah.
It doesn't know how to read social situations. Some inappropriate beats, you know, are intruding on, like, how it relates its narrative. And it's just generally rather...
You mean like the bit where the first night they spend in the same bed is because that he's gone out drinking at the bar she works at?
Yeah.
Gets way too drunk and passes out.
And
she decides to sleep next to him in the same bed, naked, anyway?
Yeah.
And she just excuses it as, oh, this is just how I sleep.
All right.
Well, maybe you should have slept on the couch that night?
Yeah.
You know, I'm just saying, it kind of makes you look like a hussy. I'm just saying.
Me likey. Anyway,
but yeah, it's, you know, and then, you know, post Three on a Meat Hook, Girdler attracted the attention of Samuel Arkoff, who was running American International Pictures at the time. Did a couple blaxploitation features. He did Sheba Baby with Pam Grier. He made the black themed Exorcist ripoff Abby, and got the pantsuit off of him for it. To the point where Abby's still kind of difficult to find these days. And then he got his big break in terms of the film called Grizzly. Grizzly!
I'm going to let you handle the intro to Grizzly because you're clearly more excited about Grizzly than I am.
I am. I think Grizzly is a lot of fun. And precisely because it is what it is, it's a gigantic Jaws ripoff, but with an enormous angry bear. And it knows it's a gigantic Jaws ripoff, but with an enormous angry bear. And it doesn't care. It's like, yeah, so what? I know that we're just filling product here, but I'm going to make the most panache-worthy and energetic product I can.
Panache-worthy, pardon me, folks, but this film ends with the bear being blown up with a balloon.
Yes!
There is no panache.
Oh, there is. The waterfall killing, come on.
The waterfall killing is appropriately preposterous.
But it's...
A woman is...
It's preposterous, but it's well-framed. And it's well shot, and it's the shock effect is well timed.
But it's not well framed in the sense that there's an intelligence behind saying, "Oh, this is going to be," or there's it's not appropriate framed in the sense that when I look at that, I get like gripped by fear by watching. Oh shit!
No.
There's a bear having his arm grabbing behind this woman throwing her body.
I'm not claiming Grizzly scary. I don't think it was trying to be scary, honestly, but. I think it works from an entertainment perspective.
But watching a bear being blown up by a bazooka is entertaining.
But see, the thing is, I think it at some core level it acknowledges that it's ludicrous.
Yeah.
And it has fun with that. You can't seriously put Christopher George holding a bazooka on screen and be like, this is serious filmmaking.
Yeah, that's true.
But anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Like, we should at least intro the film properly.
A bear. Grizzly
is a film about a bear running wild in a national park, and in the Roy Scheider role you have Christopher George, he of the perpetually snide and annoyed look. In the Richard Dreyfuss role you
no,
have...
No, what did I see Christopher George in recently? I just saw him.
Oh, you saw him in Pieces.
I saw him in Pieces?
Yes, which is possibly the greatest achievement of Western civilization.
It's lots of fun. Lots of boobs, lots of blood.
And lots of ridiculousness. It's kind of great.
It's very fun.
But, and then in the Richard Dreyfuss role, you have Andrew Prine as a no-nonsense helicopter pilot. And in the Robert Shaw role, you have Richard Jekyll as a naturist who knows everything there is to know about grizzly bears.
And he tells it to you in such depth that you
can't help. Oh, yes, he does.
Boring.
He has knowledge and he wants you to know it.
Oh my god, these monologues that this character has are so boring.
They're pretty dull, and they do drag the film down. But then you do have bits where, you know, every time you think the film's about to go off the cliff and get thoroughly boring, then the bear will show up and behead a horse.
Watching a bear decapitate a horse is awesome.
Yeah, or, you know, take a hunter and throw him in a river. Just because, you know, you're in my territory. Get out! I just think that it is a well-made, it's a rip-off that's well-made, and well-paced, and perfectly entertaining. And
I take issue with that, because honestly, I think that, like so many things, if I'm going to be impressed with a film purely on the level of its preposterousness, this thing has to go for the throat consistently enough that I feel like there's more than just a few YouTube search-worthy scenes. And I think Grizzly has some great YouTube-worthy scenes, but frankly, if you were to try to watch the rest of the film, you'd be like, I mean, it's a real slog. It's like a lot of giallo films. You watch these films because they have a spectacular sense of atmosphere, in large part. But when it comes down to, like, the procedural aspect, you know, the meat and potatoes bit of storytelling...
Well, yeah, it's ridiculous.
They suck. And this is what something we'll go into about the Manitou that I take issue with.
Yeah.
I think Girdler doesn't care fundamentally about the concern at the heart of a movie as silly as Grizzly. Grizzly is a film that if you're going to at least do something memorably silly with, you have to have some level of Larry Cohen-esque faith that there's something there in the scenario in the first place worthy of, if not like going out on a limb to expand upon, something that's worth, you know, making fun of. Something, there's got to be something there that this guy finds interesting enough to expand upon. I don't think he's found that. I don't think he's found his way into the scenario enough to have anything more than accidentally interesting and engaging scenes like the bazooka, like the
scene,
beheading.
The scene where the kid and his rabbit gets eaten?
I mean, I like that one action scene I do like in that. I don't think it's especially well choreographed, but I like the idea of who's the character with the gun in the tower that's being... The bear is shaking.
Oh, it's one of the ranger deputies.
One of the ranger deputies is being is up in a watchtower in the forest, and the bear is like shaking the foundation of this tower, and the guy's trying to shoot it unsuccessfully, and the bear is just going at the base.
The bear is shaking the shit out of this tower,
and it's great because like you know you actually get a sense that there's stakes to the scene. You are just like oh shit that you're actually seeing the thing falling. There's you know there's enough thought put into it that I was drawn to it. I would say I was involved, immersed into it, but I was certainly I held my attention.
Yeah.
And that's my problem. The idea is that if Girdler actually had gone further, I think you'd have a more interesting film. I think that scene is symptomatic of the fact that you have what could be in the right hands and in the right, you know, frame of mind, a very very engaging film, but
that's the thing. I mean, I've seen a lot of films where people try to take ridiculous scenarios seriously and invest them with a certain sense of gravity, and it doesn't work. And that includes Larry Cohen. If you've seen The Stuff, I mean, Jesus Christ,
I love The Stuff.
Oh God.
Okay, The Stuff
is terrible.
The Stuff is not terrible.
It's so
The Stuff at least has the advantage of having a filmmaker that actually believes in its value as not necessarily a serious consumerist critique, but in the idea that there's something to the idea that, like, there is such power to advertising and to, you know, if you put it in people's marketplaces and flood the market with a certain product, everyone won't be able to succumb to its allure.
You can't miss that because he hits us with a sledgehammer with that over and over. That's the entire film.
I don't think it's to the. I think that that belief, no matter how blunt it may be, makes the film.
Well, anyway,
pretty interesting. Or even if you ignore the fun creature effects in that film, that movie I think has something. It has a level of inspiration that Grizzly just doesn't for me.
I don't want to get on track here. The main point I was trying to make was that I've seen a lot of people, you know, try to take premises seriously like that, and then they don't work.
You don't even
have to take hold on. You know what? Having seen some of Girdler's other films, I probably don't want him to take this seriously. I don't necessarily think he's that kind of director.
You're confusing my point here. I don't necessarily think that he needs to take it seriously. I think he needs to find something in it that he finds worthy of, you know, exploring. It could be something worthy of making fun of.
I think he did, personally. And that something is lots and lots of gory bear attacks.
Not nearly enough, my friend. If it were, like, nothing but, like, a 50-minute Kenneth Anger short film of bear attacks, nude girls, you know, and...
If it was a 50-minute short film of bear attacks and nude girls, it would be the best movie ever made.
It would be. And unfortunately...
But it also wouldn't be a William Girdler film. And let's be honest, that's what we're here to talk about.
Well, that's my thing. The William Girdler films that we're talking about are all fundamentally interesting.
They are fundamentally interesting.
Except for Grizzly.
I think Grizzly is fundamentally interesting.
I think Grizzly could have been interesting, but it's the classic scenario of what we were talking about before the podcast, and you're like, we're here to evaluate what's on screen, not what could have been. And in this case, because what's on screen is so lifeless, I don't see any potential beyond the, it could have worked if such and such, and, you know, like, if my grandma had wheels, she'd be a bus.
See, I think there is a lot of life on the screen, and I really enjoyed it. I think a lot of the main actors who were cast because of their, you know, the iconic, you know, meat they brought to the roles that they're playing. Because, like, you know, Christopher George does play the hard ass a lot, and yeah, that's kind of what he does. And you know, Andrew Prine plays, you know, the slightly off sort of deputy role in a lot of films, like he did that in you know, The Town That Dreaded Sundown and stuff like that. And you know, Richard Jekyll is, you know, he's, you know, the sort of, you know, the voice of authority, you know, kind of
weird.
Yes, it's I think, I don't know, I really had a lot of fun with it, and I enjoyed it.
Now the difference, and the reason why I think. I will say
I didn't have as much fun as the film we're about to segue into. Though.
The Manitou. The Manitou is easily the best Willem Gertler film. Yeah. But in terms of both conception and in terms of ideas, etc. Because here we're working with a scenario that Gertler didn't originally come up with.
No, it's based on a Graham Masterson novel.
Yes. Now, here, in that sense, you at least have him working with someone who at some point believed in the material he was working with. He's working with someone else's vision.
Well, but no, let's be fair. I mean, in both you know, Three and a Meat Hook and Grizzly, he's also basically working with someone else's vision.
But
it's just he's not working off an established screenplay. He's just working off other people's films and, you know, consciously trying to ape them.
But the fact is, in Asylum of Satan, he finds his way in through the Wizard of Oz illusions. He finds his way in through the by exploring the contours of the space in the asylum.
I think what you're seeing there is a hunger, you know, that sort of young, let's go out and make a movie and let me prove myself kind of thing. You know, there's, for lack of a better word, an enthusiasm there.
Oh, sure.
That maybe isn't reflected in the final product, but it's the kind of film that if you were involved with it, you could probably point to and go, I helped make that. It was a lot of fun.
But I wasn't involved in the making of that, and I still see that enthusiasm translate in the way that he films. Finds things to get excited about in the film scenario. And I think that when you get to Grizzly, it's not there. But however, you get to the Manitou, it's not only a fun setup, it's, for the first half at least, a pretty engrossing follow-through. Tony Curtis plays a tarot card reader in San Francisco, and he's a sham, he's a phony. he caters to little old ladies that are afraid of dying.
Guard well the pips, and the fruit shall grow again.
Yes, he teaches this one old lady this motto, which he himself gets wrong when he tries to repeat it to her.
I love that first scene where they're introducing, you know, him as a sham medium.
Yeah.
I love what he's predicting. He's predicting these totally boring, mundane things. He's, on Monday, you shall drop something on your foot. And on Tuesday, you will play bridge with your normal bridge group, and someone will cheat. Wednesday, you will get an obscene phone call. And Thursday, you will have gas pain. I'm not making any of these up. These are all actual predictions from the movie.
I was there. I
Tony Curtis is talking to an old lady about the potential of her getting gas pain.
And that's why
one of the many reasons this movie is so great.
It's endearing. It's very first half of the film, I think, is very endearing, because to me, in that setup, you have Gertler feels comfortable enough to invest at least in like the power of the film's ideas.
It's ridiculous, and he's grooving on the ridiculousness.
Well, it's not ridiculous, but he accepts the fact that there is something to the character's cynicism, which he finds appealing.
No, like, I mean the whole scenario is ridiculous.
I know the whole scenario is ridiculous, but I don't think he believes in it. And we'll go into that. But the fact is, yeah. Okay, so once, from that point
we
on,
actually say the entirety of the scenario.
I was about to do that. Okay. I was doing that.
Okay, well, fine.
Thank you.
Be that way.
Thank you.
Be that way.
Thank you.
Be that way.
So his friend, played by Susan Susan Strasberg, plays his friend who is asking him to go out of his way to hold her hand, basically, while she goes in for surgery to have a tumor removed from the base of her neck. That tumor turns out to be a possessed fetus of an evil centuries-old shaman that's trying to resurrect the devil!
Yes, this is a real plot.
Yeah.
It's a thoroughly bonkers, nutty, ridiculous movie that a lot of people who are far too talented for this material are involved with.
Yeah, Strasberg and Curtis.
Burgess Meredith shows up in a cameo.
Oh my god!
Pure comedic gold.
It's so
the pauses in his dialogue are just epic. Was it? What I wrote in my book was, "Oh, it's not here."
Meredith is wonderful.
Burgess Meredith is amazing at it. Michael Ansara is great. Because they're all playing to this material's level. And there's something beautiful about that. Like, people taking this... You know, the film it made me think of a lot while I was watching it was Dreamcatcher.
I haven't seen it.
You haven't seen Dreamcatcher. Well, you need to see Dreamcatcher. But Dreamcatcher, much like The Manitou, is based on a book with material in it. And I know this for a fact, Dreamcatcher, because I've read about half of it. And the thing is, both books are centered around things that work in print. Like, you can totally sell the idea of an Indian medicine man growing inside a tumor on a woman's neck in print. Or you can totally sell the idea of aliens invading people's bodies and then being born through unearthly farts. You can sell that in print, because you can describe it in ways that are weird and unearthly and really tough to imagine. But you visualize that, and it becomes ridiculous.
It does.
Like, the whole house of cards just falls down.
But on top of that, what I take issue with is that I don't think Girdler actually, again, has found a way to make this idea that Curtis's character, a sham mystic, has found a form of mysticism that works terrifying. I think in the first half, when it's basically just a bunch of unnatural phenomena, like a woman floating a few feet off the ground and screaming.
And then falling downstairs and taking the entire banister with her.
Yes, that like that, or the seance they conduct where, like, all these lights are flickering. Those scenes he does pretty well. But once he actually has to go into the idea that there's shamanism involved, that there's a level of Native American mysticism involved, I think the film falls apart for me, because I don't think Girdler believes in this scenario to the point where you get anything more than a very entertaining and silly B-movie. Like, it could have been an Exorcist-level film, I think, if he actually had that basic faith that there's something worthy of being scared of here.
But, well, here's a question. What's wrong with being a silly and entertaining B-movie?
That's fine if you're willing to enjoy it on that level, but the fact is, in that first half of the film, I was deeply invested in it. I grew to love the characters in a way that I was really let down by that second half.
See, I don't know. I don't think I was ever really taking it seriously. From the moment Tony Curtis starts dancing to porn funk in his living room, it just seems just so fundamentally goofy.
Well, okay, but you have to understand, the fact is that, like, that scene just sets up the fact that that scene within a context makes sense. Everything in that first half is not out of reason. Even the scene where a surgeon tries to initially cut out the tumor
Cutting his own wrist, yes.
Yeah, exactly. That, again, was within a realm of where I felt like I could easily suspend my disbelief. I didn't feel that way at the second half once the Native American shaman that, what's his name?
Michael Ansara.
Michael Ansara plays. Once he comes into the picture, I totally don't buy any of it, because I don't think Girdler does. And, like, by the time you get to a scene where Susan Strasberg is shooting lasers in outer space while Tony Curtis is standing in a doorway in the middle of outer space for some reason, and there's a midget, you know, evil shaman that's laughing his head off, which something is probably not that funny. Yes. And he's laughing, Susan Strasberg shooting lasers, there's a giant eye, several triple exposures in outer space of a giant eye that's having lasers shot out from Susan Strasberg's hands. Tony Curtis is looking very confused while he's marshaling the Manitou spirits of all the computers in a hospital to fight with Susan Strasberg to destroy the evil Native American shaman that's in floating outer space. I have to wonder, what happened to that really
Let me just reiterate. We're not making any of that up.
We're not making any
all
of that.
All that happens.
And it's
And I will say that I think that there is a level in which Girdler doesn't buy into. Well, I can't exactly accuse Girdler of this, because I don't know if this comes from the Masterson source or not. But I think it's not just Girdler. I think the script itself doesn't buy into the whole Indian mysticism.
Oh, sure.
Because that's kind of the point of the climax, that the Indian mystic can't defeat Miss Guamaka. and they have to resort to what's literally called, in the film, white man's magic. It's totally an imperialist narrative.
But in that sense, if it's totally an imperialist narrative, there has to be something serious enough to say, like, oh, well, what's the one way to defeat mysticism, you know, like hard science? You have to have a level of faith that could actually happen, that works, that there's...
No, you don't.
I do. I think you do.
That's nice.
I think you fucking do.
No, I think this movie... I saw this movie when I was 16 and hated it, and now I know that my 16-year-old self was an idiot.
I enjoy it for the most part, but I think, honestly, like, there's this great scene where Tony Curtis comes out of the elevator in the hospital after, like, the evil Native American devil has been unleashed by the evil shaman tumor that's been put on Susan.
How can you even say that with a straight face? The premise itself invites ridiculousness.
But the fact is, in the first half, it's not so ridiculous that I can't, like, actually get involved. The difference. And anyway, so Tony Curtis is going into this elevator, and there's giant icicles that look like they belong in that scene in Logan's Run with the robot, with the killer robot that's like, I'm going to kill everyone with this turkey car.
I would like to say Curtis is kind of variable in this film. But there is one moment he has that I think is absolutely perfect. And it does actually take place in the first half of the film when the film is, by your standards, ostensibly taking itself seriously. It's when the main doctor on Strasburg's case is explaining that, you know, the tumor is actually a fetus. And then Curtis goes, on her neck? And it's just the way he nails that line. It's just this perfect combination of interest and disbelief with a slight undercurrent of amusement. Like, he doesn't know whether to, like, be confused or scared or laugh. And it's just this perfect tone, and he just gets it right. And I can understand what you're saying, honestly. Like, if the whole film was pitched at, like, that, like, right there, it would be... People would know it. It would be considered a classic of the horror genre. But, you know, that's not what we're dealing with here.
I don't even necessarily want it to be a respectable classic. I could be okay with being a camp classic. If from start to finish, I got a sense that there was something that he was just like, I believe in how silly this is, and he just consistently goes for it. I don't think that's there.
See, I got that right from the beginning.
The point that I was trying to
make... Come on, Tony Curtis takes a fake mustache off and slaps on his wall.
within the context of the first
thing
half,
is, this thing is
sense.
Top to bottom ridiculous.
No, because Tony Curtis, in that sense, is just showing you in that scene how little he has faith in this, in like the idea of mysticism. You know, again, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Within context, it's not ridiculous in the sense of like, oh wow, this is actually happening. That Susan Strasberg shooting lasers at him. You know, I don't have to go into this. And the fact is, there's a really good scene let me finish my thought, please.
Okay, sure.
There's a scene where Tony Curtis goes into this hospital lobby, and there's icicles everywhere. And it's, you know, the effect is it's really cheesy. There's lots of really bad and, like, poorly, production value-wise, like, icicles hanging from everywhere. But it's a spooky scene just because the camera has this really effective... tracking shot that's just pulling away from Tony Curtis as he's just looking, and he's, you know, that is partly his acting, but it's partly just the way that the scene is filmed. Like, you actually feel compelled to want to see, like, holy shit, what's going on here?
I would like to point out that the camera work in this film, the cinematography, is generally very effective.
Yeah.
It's done by a fellow whose name is Michel... He's a Frenchman. It's Michel something, and the last name escapes me. I looked it up earlier, but I forgot to write it down. But it's a fellow who did a lot of work, a lot of genre work, a lot of TV work, shot a lot of episodes of Mission Impossible. But also in the late 70s, he also shot Head, the Monkees film, which is incredible if you've not seen it. And he also shot Jacques Demy's English language film Model Shop, so
which nobody has seen.
Actually, it's got quite a following. Just
like
you,
who?
Just because you haven't seen it.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't seen it.
So you haven't seen it, and I haven't seen it. So solipsistically speaking, no one has seen it.
Well played. All right, I'll accept that. But I just I don't know. I really enjoyed this movie. Because I think it's kind of ridiculous from stem to stern. And I understand it gets more ridiculous near the end. Definitely. I mean, there's nothing in the first half of the film to compete with Susan Strasberg firing lasers in space.
Pew, pew,
I will
pew.
Not argue with you on that. But even when Michael Ansara is introduced as the, you know, the men, when Curtis is going around looking for a medicine man, Curtis has to say with a straight face when Ansara says, "What does a white man want with Indian magic?" And instantly, I rewound this line like 6 times, and I still can't quite figure out what Curtis is saying. But to the best of what my ears can hear, he's saying, "There's a 400-year-old medicine man that's taken the way of the oil on the neck of a woman that I know." And he has to say this with a straight face. You know, and there's a lot of the dialogue just when dealing with the scenario is very ridiculous. And like I was especially hoping that when Michael Ansara asked why should I help Whitey, Curtis would go, "I'm an Italian. I didn't oppress you."
Really? Yeah, I think that, again, like I think that if he had found the humor in there and he made it seem as if like it was grounded in like at least a level of understandable preposterousness.
Yeah.
Okay, but the fact is that like the first half of the film just feels like a totally different film than the second half.
All right. I disagree, but I can understand where you're coming from with that. But the thing, I'm actually really happy with this particular podcast, or at least the theme, because I was walking in kind of dreading it, because like I said, I'd seen The Manitou several years back and really disliked it, and I saw Asylum of Satan last year and really disliked it. So I had this image of Gertler in my head as this guy who was like, "No, I don't want to do this." And now I'm coming out and going, you know what? I'm kind of okay with this guy.
Right.
Like, I can imagine if he'd survived, I can imagine him being like, you know, in the 80s being like a Sidney J. Fury or a Joseph Zito or something like that, you know? Like, someone who could make reliably ridiculous B-movies. Like, Golan Globus would have loved this motherfucker.
Golan Globus would have... He doesn't deserve Golan Globus, put it that way.
I'm just saying, they would have gotten him to make something at some point. Can you imagine him making Cobra?
Touché.
Yes! Come on, William Girdler's Cobra would be infinitely better than the Cobra we have now.
I agree. And on that note, let's move on to the Netflix grab bag for this month.
Yes.
Where, if you're joining us for the first time, which I sincerely doubt you are, Netflix grab bag is a feature where we choose... films each month different from either my queue or Steve's queue, either Netflix or either the instant queue or the
physical
disc queue. And we, because you know, the idea that you had all these titles through Netflix queue and a lot of them just wind up staying in your queue for years, we just needed a little boost to randomly pick a few titles, and we ask you, the listener, to vote for one of four films that we randomly pick from our queues, and we just have you pick it, vote for it, we watch it, and we review it. These aren't necessarily bad films, they're just badly chosen films.
They're just films that we've looked at one day and went, "Oh, I'd like to see that," and then we stuck them in our queue and we forgot about them.
Right.
And they're residing somewhere in the middle distance, the kind of things that we would never really bring up to the top if we weren't being told to by you, the listener.
Thank you, listener.
So
this month we chose from Steve's queue for DVDs, physical DVDs.
Yes.
And the film that you voted for, undoubtedly because of its kick-ass title, is Werewolves on Wheels.
Yes, Werewolves on Wheels.
You can tell this is Steve's queue.
Yes. Are you saying you wouldn't have Werewolves on Wheels in your queue?
No comment.
Are you saying normal people don't have Werewolves on Wheels on their queue? Okay, you're right. Anyway, Werewolves on Wheels is, it's kind of a what it says in the tin kind of film, except that the werewolves don't actually show up until very late into the film. It's kind of holding that as a surprise.
There's very few werewolves in a film about werewolves.
I pointed out to my wife last night because, I actually, wasn't able to get the film from Netflix on time, so I ordered it from Amazon, and I got 2-day shipping on it, so now I own the movie.
Oh, yeah!
Yeah, because that's just how cool I am. And I pointed out that there are actually, on the cover of the DVD, there are twice as many werewolves on the cover of the DVD as there actually are in the film. Which is a... And the film actually lies in the title, because there are no werewolves on wheels. We get one werewolf. on wheels. The other werewolf is killed before it can even jump on a bike.
Yeah, that's true. So, that werewolf does not get on wheels.
And so, incidentally, I'm sorry if I just spoiled werewolves on wheels for you.
Spoiler!
But if you actually care about werewolves on wheels being spoiled, you're kind of lame. So
lame!
Anyway, what Werewolves on Wheels is a biker film.
Yes.
Crossbred with a werewolf film.
It's basically Easy Rider with werewolves, because the fact is bad.
Well, werewolves and Satanists.
Focusing on werewolves. Because werewolf, for the most part.
But see, that's the thing. I don't think the film... I don't think the film wants to focus on just the werewolves, but we'll get into that.
The fact is that the idea that this film has is, and the reason why I bring up Easy Rider is because it's very serious about the idea that these characters are going through an existential crisis at the thought of, like, being out on the open road, being alienated from their countrymen, being isolated, being psychologically, you know, distant from each other and emotionally distant from each other. Even though they do a lot of the things that stereotypical bikers do, you know, they have loose women, they fool around, they drink beer, they enjoy the open air. Mm. You know, it's the stereotypical. Anarchist idea of freedom.
What you're saying is that instance near the end of the film where they all drive into a dust storm and end up lost in this endless expanse of desert. Are you saying that's a metaphor?
Not really.
Bum bum bum.
It's
totally a metaphor.
The fact is, yes, exactly. This film takes itself very seriously, and I'm convinced that the Easy Rider analogy isn't just a stretch, because these people are taking themselves so seriously that the fact that there happens to be werewolves in the film seems to just be a cover for, like, the ideas that it wants to discuss, ideas that are discussed at greater and better length in movies like Easy Rider. The idea that these people are... You know, they're longing for something that, like, in the process of pursuing makes them feel...
Or Devil's Angels, if you haven't seen that one.
Or Wild Angels.
Yeah.
The idea is that, again, we're dealing with a very serious psychological thriller that also happens to have, like, two or three scenes of werewolves.
It's like director Michel Levesque was handed a title and told to make a movie with that title, and... He turned out, like, the most serious version of that he could. Like, the most, you know, like, the most thoughtful attempt at that. Like, it's like when John McTiernan was told to make a horror film. You know, just give it money. Like, go out and make a cheap horror movie. And he comes back with his distributor with Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. Or, you know, when John Carpenter was told, go out and make The Babysitter Murders. And he comes back with Halloween. You know, it's someone taking something that's fundamentally ridiculous and trying to do something... expressive and unique with it. And I think the casting of the lead biker is played by Steve Oliver, who showed up in several biker films throughout the 60s and 70s, but he's best known for his lead role in Russ Meyer's Black Snake. So the casting of him is kind of, you know, important and iconic there. And, like, biker dude in a movie about bikers who don't really know.
Just dudes.
They don't really know where they're going. They're kind of lost. And, you know, it's... But what I do think is most interesting about this film, and I think it's kind of sad that it does eventually abandon it, I guess necessarily so, given the way the plot progresses, but, I mean, I've seen several biker films, and the appeal of them is kind of in their shapelessness, in that the idea is that you get to hang out, you know, the plot is secondary, the point of the film is going there to hang out with a biker crew.
Right.
And you get to, you know, be at their parties and watch them have fun with their women and they drink beer and do drugs and, you know, whatever, man. You know, you're just here to have a good time. Mm-hmm. But very early on in the film, and it kind of holds on to this for about, you know, half an hour to 40 minutes, it takes that shapelessness of the biker lifestyle and contrasts it against the very regimented, very ritualized, structured, you know, Satanist scene that they stumble upon, where, right, you know, where there's you know, they're performing this religious ritual that ends up cursing two of the bikers who then become werewolves.
Right.
But there's a very conscious tension between the very organized ritual of the Satanists versus the very loose sort of shaggy existence of the bikers. And what kind of causes the curse is when those two worlds collide. And the bikers beat up the Satanists and take their woman back, who was kind of there of her own free will and kind of not. It's kind of confusing the way it's cut into the film.
My main objection to the Werewolf on Wheels, even though I actually kind of enjoy it for its I don't know what I'm looking at factor, the fact is that, like, that shapelessness that you describe, it's a classic case of a film succumbing to the condition that it's trying to describe and represent.
Yeah.
The pacing is ridiculously lousy.
And that's what I mean by, and well, that's a problem that crops up in a lot of lesser biker films. But that's kind of what I mean when I say it abandons that sort of fascinating structural tension. When they ride away from the Satanists and then, you know, go into the second half of the film kind of literally gets lost. And in a sequence like the bit where they get lost in the dust cloud and end up in the desert, you can kind of see it's kind of intended as a metaphorical thing. Where, you know, they're literally lost. They don't know where they're going. They're just driving around with no aim and no destination and America! You know, but...
Did you know America?
But it does become kind of a chore to watch. It does become kind of a chore to watch, you know?
Yes. And that's the thing, like, I think that the actual, like, the scenes where the three scenes or whatever with the werewolves are actually kind of cool, but because they just seem to be, like, stuff... The monsters are filmed like you're looking at them out of the corner of your eye. They're like, they're very much, you know, monsters that are totally on the periphery of the film's vision. They're kind of accidental, and that's why it's misleading to watch a film called Werewolves on Wheels, expecting a movie that's full-on about werewolves, bikers, you know, something that's ridiculous, yeah. itself as seriously as that, you know?
And that's kind of one of the reasons I'm blasé about spoilers for this movie. Not just because it was made in 1971, and if you're worried about a 40-year-old film being spoiled, fuck you. But also because the film spoils itself in the title.
Yeah.
Because the way the film is made, the werewolves are clearly being held as a surprise. And, you know, it's like, it'd be like if you made Psycho and called it the guy who dressed up as his mom and killed people.
On wheels.
On wheels! Actually, I'd watch the fuck out of that.
I would too.
But it's, you know... And the real disappointing thing about it is it's not poorly made. It's actually a pretty well-directed film, I think. I think that Levesque shows at least a base knowledge of film grammar and cutting and what to put after another thing for maximum effect. Like, you know, the cuts from, like, you know, long shots to sudden smash cuts of close-up of eyeballs.
Yeah.
And, you know, the framing of the first werewolf killing, the rape me, Satan, scene, where all of a sudden, hey, careful what you wish for there, lady.
Yeah, really.
Where one guy's chasing after this lady, and all of a sudden, the camera keeps panning, and all of a sudden, now you're watching in shadow as a dude suddenly turns into a werewolf and kills this lady. But it's, you know, it's very, very oblique, and I think it's very interestingly made, much more so than you'd expect a film with that title to be.
Absolutely. I was taken aback by how ambitious it was, how absolutely just compelling on a I'm not sure where this film is going next level,
yeah.
Because you're right, it is technically polished to a certain degree, and for all of its, you know, for all of its faults in terms of understanding where it should go next, again, to the intuitive level of filmmaking that we're talking about with Girdler, there is at least, the difference here is that, unlike Girdler, the director of Werewolves on Wheels actually believes in the premise that there is a way that you could take seriously the idea of a biker werewolf.
Yeah.
And
you can kind of see this kind of, you know, these guys are animals, and, well, what, it's just the logical extension of that.
Yeah.
Except that, you know, but anyway.
Could you mean that literally?
Yes, yes.
But,
there's an early line of dialogue where the mystic in the guy in the group, their spiritual guide, who in a baldly metaphorical moment, when they're lost in the desert, they beat up and leave for dead. It's like, yeah, we're lost anyway, so whatever. We're leaving God behind.
Basically.
But it's this guy who can predict the future using tarot cards, and he says, it means your end is predetermined by fate. Nothing you can do to change it. And the lead biker says, bullshit! But it turns out, guess what? You can't. And I think the film's trying to get at that, at, you know, even within something, a lifestyle so loose that there is a predetermined structure.
Well, yeah,
I think that's why they contrast that with the ritual aspects of the Satanists. But it kind of loses track of that, and then you get this ridiculous non-ending where I don't exactly know what the last 5 minutes of the film are on about. With that mirroring of
the werewolves,
the bikers and the Satanists, and we are all one, and then cut to credits. It's like, what? Did somebody forget to shoot an ending here? Is that why this thing's only 79 minutes long?
Well, I think it goes into the nihilistic idea that you were talking about, the idea that nothing can be changed, that everything that they dismissed about, like, how, like, there's no God here, there is a Satan, though.
Yeah.
And the fact is that, like,
It is kind of interesting to note that for a film that's so heavily involved Satanism, there's no godly aspect.
Yeah, there's no counterpoint to that. And that's what's interesting, because, like, the idea that, like, there is an inevitability and a plan to the actions of these characters, that the fact that all that is predetermined not by, like, a benevolent God, but by, like,
Satan.
That's interesting. I just wish the filmmakers had actually, like, explicitly dealt with that.
We're essentially lost in a moral and spiritual desert.
Yeah.
So.
Of Satan!
Satan! And werewolves!
And cultists. And a girl that wants to be raped
by Satan.
Yeah. Anyway, so
I think we've gotten all the meat we can out of that. So. Yeah.
The choices for next month's grab bag are taken from my instant queue.
And I would just like to point out that apropos of nothing, Werewolves on Wheels also has one biker doing possibly the worst John Wayne impression I've ever heard.
Oh yeah. Do it.
So I can't. It's
singular.
It's awful and
idiosyncratic.
That's a good way to talk about it.
Eccentric.
Yes, it's so awful that I was watching Werewolves and Wheels with my wife in the room. She was sort of half watching, half listening. And when she heard, you know, when I point out that guy's doing the worst John Wayne impression I've ever heard, she goes, "Is that what he's doing?" I was wondering what was up with that. That's how bad it is.
Right.
Anyway, so
the titles for next month that you can vote for, and please vote, are Clint Eastwood's The Iger Sanction, the movie where Clint Eastwood climbs a mountain.
Over and over.
And over again. And
I believe Matt Prager is a big booster of this one.
Hi, Matt. Please listen. Please vote, Matt. Anyway, so Clint Eastwood, this is actually, fun fact, this is the film that, if you're watching Taxi Driver closely, when when Travis Bickle,
he didn't seem that hostile.
When Travis Bickle is taking his date out to see that Swedish porn, and they go out, and he's like, "What's wrong?" Across the street from the theater, Lyric Theater, I should add, is a marquee showing the Iger Sanction. So fun.
One for the nerds.
There you go. So there's the 1975 mountain climbing film starring Clint Eastwood versus a mountain. There's also Destiny, a Fritz Lang film from 1921.
The 21? Wow.
Yeah, 1921, baby.
Damn.
I have no idea what this film's about. Let's find out.
Well, while Simon's figuring that out, I will mention the third film that you have to vote for is The Funeral. The Abel Ferrara film.
It's with Christopher Walken.
Christopher Walken and Vincent Gallo and the late Chris Penn. And, yeah.
What's that one about? Well, anyway.
It's about a funeral.
Oh, it's about a funeral. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
There's gangsters involved in it, too.
Yes, there's gangsters.
Christopher Walken
and a funeral. I think it's about flashbacks leading up, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's about flashbacks leading up to the death of Vincent Gallo's character. So.
Sounds good to me. Destiny is about, as a young couple stops and rests in a small village inn, the man is abducted by death and is sequestered behind a huge, doorless, windowless wall. Well, that sounds great.
That actually sounds pretty awesome,
the
honestly.
The woman finds a mystic entrance and is met by Teth, who tells her three separate stories set in exotic locales, all involving circumstances similar to hers. In each story, a woman trying to save her lover from his ultimate tragic fate fails.
So it's Fritz Lang's Intolerance?
Alright, there's one more sentence, hold on. The young lady realizes the meeting of the tales and takes the only step she can to reunite herself with her lover. Which I'm guessing means dead. She does, she does. Spoilered!
Bum, bum, bum!
But anyways, Fritz Lang is probably pretty terrific, I would assume.
I would assume so, too.
So yeah, the Ferrar funeral, Long's destiny, Eastwood's Iger Sanction, or
Brad Anderson's happy accidents.
Which, I know Steve doesn't like Brad Anderson.
Not a fan.
I think that, with the exception of the TV work I've seen directed by Anderson, Anderson's a pretty interesting guy, even though I didn't like Vanishing on 7th Street. I do enjoy Trans-Siberian and The Machinist.
Let me qualify that with the only Anderson film I have enjoyed thus far is Next Stop Wonderland, which, like Happy Accidents, is non-genre.
Yeah.
So,
well, no, it's not non-genre. It's the genre elements of it are submerged, I think, to the point where it's not really science fiction or horror. It's like, you know, more lighthearted.
Yeah. It's a romantic comedy with unusual elements.
Yeah, exactly.
So if I were to watch another Brad Anderson film, Happy Accidents wouldn't be the worst idea.
Yeah, Vincent D'Onofrio stars as a mental patient who claims he's from the future.
Right.
And I'm pretty positive that we're going to find out if we wind up watching the film that he actually is from the future, if not that.
I'm just saying any film with Vincent D'Onofrio claiming to be as a mental patient claiming to be from the future can't be all bad.
Method acting. Anyway, so. But yeah, those are your choices. Please feel free to vote. For God's sake, somebody leave a comment in the comment section, because this is getting depressing, people.
Aww.
Why do we do this if you don't listen?
Oh, they listen. They love us.
What should we do for November, Steve?
I have no frickin' idea, honestly.
Thanksgiving theme. What are we thankful for?
Shitty movies.
I don't know if we're thankful for that.
I am.
I'm thankful for shitty movies.
I have to admit, I watch
a manner of shitty
movies. I watch enough shitty movies that I have to obviously be looking for them.
Yes, but why? I mean, let's think. Should we do something on pink films? That could be fun.
Could be.
Because half of these, the films that are available through labels like Pink Ega are pretty lousy. I mean, although those are technically adult video entertainment, AB films, not pink.
Yeah.
But they're all softcore porn, and hence to our white, painfully white audience, it probably is all the same.
But I'll tell you what, let's discuss this over beer, and we will...
We'll think about it. We'll and think if about you it. Have suggestions, hey, that's an idea, put it in the fucking comment section! Please, listen to this podcast! We're begging you! Okay, bye now!